I recommend is become a BAI buddy. It's $10 a month. But, hey, yes, it's more than the $25 subscription to the station, but becoming a BAI buddy entitles you, well, to give us $10 a month. There are also other incentives, many of which are being thought of down the line. Somebody's actually been coming up with great premium ideas. I believe right now, if you go to the BAI website at WBAI.org and become a BAI buddy, I think you're entered into a lottery or raffle in order to win an iPad. Or actually a MacBook Air. Something cool. I don't know which it is. It's Apple. I don't know which it is. But it's cool, all right? The way to get it is one of two ways. Go to WBAI.org, and you will see all kinds of things entreating you to give money. Or call 212-209-2950 and pledge and say, I want to become a BAI buddy. And if you think about it, really, who doesn't? Well, we're not going to go there right now, but I think it's time to start the show. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This is a special edition beginning at 1 a.m. And aside from occasionally stopping to ask for money, we're going to spend this morning talking with Chris Claremont, like X-Men. Yeah, stay tuned. But first, Dan Persons is going to have to talk about Godzilla. He'll review X-Men next week.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Here's a thing to do if you happen to subscribe to Netflix Instant View. Go there and watch Monsters, the film that director Gareth Edwards did before he was given Godzilla. Keep your expectations in check. The film is interesting, about a photojournalist who's ordered to escort the daughter of his publisher out of Mexico after an alien infestation creates a no man's land at the U.S. border. But it has its problems, most prominently a meandering, documentary-like tone that loses the story in random character moments and characters that, frankly, you don't care much about. It's got a Wim Wenders vibe to it, and like some of Wenders' work, really only pulls itself together in the last half hour when it has some keen things to say about humanity's dominion over this world. What you will see in context to Godzilla, the film we're actually talking about here, is something of a question of scale. Despite what the calendar tells you, we are firmly in the summer film season now, and summer films are big films, big stakes, big effects, big, big monsters, big dollars at the box office if it all works, even sometimes when it doesn't actually work, because we as filmgoers are a perverse lot, aren't we? Yeah, we are. The challenge is, even as these films lean heavily on spectacle, what's there to keep it all from devolving into a computer-generated light show? What's there to make us care? Godzilla couldn't be more different from Monsters. Monsters is small and experimental. Godzilla is conventional and commercial. Yet there are things Edwards achieved in Monsters, even if he wasn't quite successful there, that he has brought over in the process of scaling up to Godzilla, and they definitely help. Some of what transfers over is obvious. The main storyline, for one thing, of Godzilla's hero, a lieutenant and demolition expert played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson, on an odyssey to get back home, back to some representation of stability and normality, even if it's clear that that may no longer exist. There's even a meeting in Godzilla of two of the Mudos, the insectoid bad guys of this film that Godzilla will eventually clash with, that directly quotes from the finale of Monsters. More important, though, is that what Edwards did in Monsters in focusing on the human aspect filters through to Godzilla. There appears to be grousing in some corners that we don't get to see the big guy, Godzilla, our film's actual star, in action enough. And true enough, through the bulk of the film, Edwards orchestrates ways of abruptly short-circuiting what we expect to be a payoff, having shelter doors cut us off from a clash, or just simply cutting away when all else fails. But that does two things. One is to forestall the big pyrotechnics for the place where they belong at the end, and I wish Michael Bay would learn that lesson. The other is to keep us connected to the humans in the midst of all this destruction, to place it at their level and make it all have stakes more compelling than just a big boom. And I'm grateful for that. Godzilla doesn't really aspire to more than being a good, solid summer action film. And it succeeds quite well at that. Better than well, even. It is really good fun. Gareth Edwards, for his part, seems to be perfectly fine with aiming for that target. Those moments that root the proceedings in humanity don't function as anything more than ways of keeping the stakes grounded between the major set pieces. But the fact that Edwards has an appreciation for how crucial that human element can be speaks well for his approach to the material. And occasionally, a little more slips in. Moving into the third act, he does something a little unusual, something that was actually in the teaser trailer, if you remember that. As our hero is parachuting into San Francisco, where Godzilla will have his final clash with the Mudos, and where just coincidentally the hero's wife and child are, just to raise those stakes, Edwards puts Ligeti's Requiem for Soprano, Mezzo-Soprano, Two Mixed Choirs and Orchestra on the soundtrack. It's a fittingly atmospheric piece for the moment. It emphasizes the eeriness of the scene these soldiers are dropping into. But an odd choice for the fact that Edwards has Alexander Desplat doing the honors as composer, and here the director has decided to go with a needle drop, recorded music, for this particular moment. until you recall that this is also the music that Stanley Kubrick used in 2001 A Space Odyssey, every time the monolith appeared, every time humanity was confronted with the realization that there exists something greater than ourselves. Not much earlier in Godzilla, Dr. Sarazawa, the film's resident Godzilla expert played by Ken Watanabe, remarks upon humanity's erroneous impression of its dominance over nature. Maybe in his choice of music, Edwards wants to replicate that notion of humanity encountering the uncanny, of abruptly getting slammed with a new perspective on humankind's place in the universe. That was also a theme explored to more affecting results in Monsters. And while here it's just a moment before we go back to the clash of big-ass monsters, what we paid our bucks for, after all, that Edwards appreciates the greater theme makes all the difference in making Godzilla more than the sum of its effects sequences. No mistake, the film is 2 hours of monster candy, really nothing more. But it's smarter monster candy, smart enough at least to know that an uncut diet of sweets isn't healthy for body or brain. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews now over at CineFantastique Online. If you want to catch up on what you missed, check us out over at cfqonline.com.
And thank you, Dan. And let me extend that .com. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And Godzilla is... I'm hearing an awful buzz over my headphones. I certainly hope that's not going through the air. And if it seems to happen, the higher I raise my mic. You know what? Let me try. I'm going to experiment with something, folks. Forgive me. Let's see now what happens if I use a different mic. Listen to all that noise. Ah. That buzz is mostly gone. So there's a faulty microphone.
Technology. What can one say? Although, in keeping with the initial, with the review, when I was a wee nubbin, like 9, 10 years old, Channel 9 Creature Features here in New York would play Americanized version of Godzilla.
The Raymond Burr
version. With Raymond Burr. And what was most interestingly significant about it for a young expat living on the south shore of Long Island, all of 30 miles outside of Manhattan, in the nuclear age, was that we had a volunteer fire department whose alert horn sounded just like Godzilla's roar.
Oh my God!
So there's nothing like being woken up.
Oh, you know, I've heard something like that. I heard that all on Long Island, all through Hurricane Sandy.
You heard Godzilla?
Yeah, yeah. I really did. Like every.
What makes you think it was a hurricane?
Ah.
He goes jogging every now and then.
Yeah.
So, you know, 2 a.m. This you'd hear the honk sound go off, and I'd be standing at the window staring out into the darkness because for some reason there also was a sound that was just like his thump, thump of, you know, him walking across the ground. And bearing in mind, Long Island is a physiognomic, you know, as a piece of natural architecture is not, how shall we say, mountainous. You right. Figured you'd ought to be able to see, well, back then he was only 300 feet tall. Goodness knows how tall he is in the current film, though based on the posters, I would have to put him somewhere just shy of the New World Trade Center, which would make him a quarter mile high,
yeah,
which is a bit disconcerting.
Yeah, except this is one of the very few movies that doesn't destroy Manhattan, so we don't have that particular scale to see him by.
Well, I was actually looking for a Jaeger.
Yes. Yes, very much so.
You know, where the heck are those steel dots?
I liked that movie. I thought Del Toro did a fun job with that. He usually does a fun job. In retrospect, I think he would have made a better Hobbit than Peter Jackson. And I figured out, I have my theory as to what Jackson is doing. Jackson, of course, was producing The Hobbit. And Del Toro, who was going to be the director, had worked on two scripts and announced that he was going to make two movies out of The Hobbit, each one 2.5 hours long. And that the first one would be The Hobbit, there and back again.
Mm-hmm.
And that the second one would be material taken from Tolkien, like the Silmarillion and various things, and would all occur between Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. And as a Tolkien purist at first, I'm going, ew, that sounds horrible. Now, what Peter Jackson has done is worse.
He's going to make another trilogy.
Well, it's not just that he's making another trilogy. Jackson... What he does, and you can see it in Lord of the Rings, where he's rather good at it, is he takes, for example, the Council of Elrond is the chapter 1, book 2 of Lord of the Rings. There are 5 books. It wasn't a trilogy, it was one novel. 5 books and three appendices. And I produced a production of the Council of Elrond, so I know it real well. In the movie, it lasts about 3 minutes long. But in the book, it's about 25, 30 pages, and it tells all these stories. Jackson took all those stories, and he showed, and they're all flashback stories, what was Gandalf doing when he left the Hobbits and so forth, and he tells them in chronological order. So he takes the material and he mixes it up. Okay. For Lord of the Rings, for the most part, that was okay. For the most part. There are a number of problems with Lord of the Rings. In The Hobbit, I believe what he has done is he has taken Del Toro's two stories and concatenated them. Which is why you have these ridiculous moments with Radagast. And the wizard with rabbits, the racing rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would that's not in The Hobbit. Radagast isn't in The Hobbit. Radagast is supposed to be in Lord of the Rings, but they don't have him in Lord of the Rings. So they take this episode, which I have no doubt would be from Del Toro's second film, and they put it in. Also, the entire stuff about the Necromancer.
The mysterious necromancer who in the second film suddenly turns into Sauron.
Yes, exactly. That would have been, again, in Del Toro's second story. Del Toro had two distinct stories, where one is a sequel to the other. Jackson has taken those and put them together into one. And as a result, you have a mishmash of bloat. I went to see the 40 frames per second IMAX 3D version of the second film, all 2 hours and 40 minutes of it. And when the film started getting good, which is to say when Smaug shows up, I was falling asleep. And the reason for that was mostly technological. If I couldn't move my head, if I moved my head, I had great seats, but if you move your head left or right, you lose the image. So it was as if, you know, like in Clockwork Orange, as if my head was clamped and forced to watch this thing. I couldn't do it. You know, when it gets to HBO, I'll watch it again.
Yeah, but by then they'll have 3D TVs and you'll be...
There are 3D TVs now. I've seen them. They're no good.
True story, I was sitting there last night watching X-Men Days of Future Past.
I've heard of that movie.
And I turn to my wife and I say, wow, this is awful. It's all out of focus. Why hasn't anybody noticed? Why hasn't anybody done something about this? And I say this apparently five times during the course of the film, though I don't recall any of it. And...
according to your wife.
Yes. And as far as she and my kid, my son, can't understand what I'm talking about because it looks just fine for them. And finally, at the end of the movie, I take off my 3D glasses and rub my eyes and look up at the screen. And it suddenly dawns on me what I've forgotten. So I reach into my pocket, take out my glasses, put my glasses on. Suddenly the screen is in focus, put on the 3D glasses, and suddenly everything is crystal clear. So just in time for the surprise ending at the back of the credits,
It's all in focus. Movie. It has to be. There has to be at least one or two inserts at the end.
Yes, I think. But look at it this way. It's the fox building a new hen house.
Yeah, absolutely. But I love that. I mean, that's not a new thing. Young Sherlock Holmes did that. Was that Barry Levinson?
Oh, yeah.
The very first major motion picture that Pixar worked on.
Mm-hmm.
And they created that great stained glass skeleton.
No, Young Sherlock Holmes is great.
Yeah, yeah. And at the end, after the whole thing is over, there's a 30-second scene of the, we believe, dead Moriarty.
Showing up in some icy landscape.
Finland.
And the name? Moriarty.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a good tradition going back
30
years. Oh, I love it. I love it. Because I am a credits watcher. I mean, doesn't matter if it's a Bergman film like Hour of the Wolf or whatever.
Well, in terms of watching credits, I'll tell you, for Days of Future Past, you'll definitely get your money's worth.
For hanging out till the very end.
No. I mean, the credits are so extraordinarily extreme and detailed. Must be a couple
coffee
of...
fetching?
No. This is just all of the folk who obviously worked on the technical side of the film.
So since we started talking, we haven't said who you are. I hope by now people sort of figured it out that...
I figured I was stealth.
Yeah, yeah. But you were somehow involved in X-Men.
It re-upped my SAG card for the first time in, God, close to a good long time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm
and
now...
You're now SAG-AFTRA.
Or AFTRA-SAG, depends on where you signed first.
Oh, no. Even here at WBAI, we were AFTRA.
No, but I was AFTRA, yeah.
We are now SAG-AFTRA. WBAI is a SAG-AFTRA station.
The card ran out 2 weeks ago, so I have to send them more money.
Ah.
Dang it. So I need a job. So if anyone out there is producing a really good film or TV show and is looking for... a slightly mature person, please call Chris Claremont, care of Marvel Comics.
Oh, no more stealth, huh?
Are you kidding? We're talking about unions here. We're talking about guaranteed real money if you can get
absolutely.
A job.
Absolutely. So at this point, Chris, people can call Marvel and reach you. I don't even know your exact current status.
I work for Marvel.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm sorry, but when we were looking at a possible movie reading based on one of your novels, and by the way, I met Chris because he also writes novels in prose through Ginger Buchanan, who was your editor at Ace, I believe.
Yes.
And she's just retired, by the way, after all these years. And she said, you want to have Chris Claremont on your show? I'm going, I know that name. She said, X-Men. Okay, I'm not, you know, that big on comics. I'm not an expert like Ken Gale or something. And she said, no, read this, First Flight. And I read it and I thought, hey, this is good stuff. And that's actually how we first met.
Well, I find it extremely kind of, well, total giggle that Jon Stewart apparently spoke quite highly of Days of Future Past the other day when James McAvoy was on. I guess this is Monday night, which, of course, I didn't watch because my kids insisted on watching Hot Fudge Part 2.
Oh, my God. Don't you have a DVR?
Hey, we're talking, you know, technologically sophisticated young men.
Yeah,
in other words,
the point is you can watch one thing and record another.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, darn, my 20th century upbringing has suddenly revealed itself yet again.
I'm older than you are, and we had this in the 20th
century. Yeah, smart Alec, I write my stories on on a notebook with pens. I don't use computers. They're very...
Cool.
Computers are cool?
It's cool that you use manuscript. I think
what program is that?
There was one. I think it was, Scribe is what I was thinking.
No, the really hard thing is when you're writing longhand and you realize your penmanship has gone to hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
I never had any. I've got third really grade creepy. Kind of stuff. I saw a manuscript once of Jane Austen's at the British Museum. And, oh, my God, she had the most perfect handwriting. Yeah. There isn't a single strike through. And she did her stuff first draft. It was amazing.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I mean, the scary thing for me is it seems as my eyesight is deteriorating. My letter forms are getting tinier. Mm. So it's like I need a giant magnifying glass just to see what I've laboriously written.
But anyhow, to get back to what I was going to say earlier, at one point you had said, I'm done with the comics industry. And that was not...
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
Yeah, exactly.
To write Nightcrawler.
Right.
Who, oddly enough, is back from the dead?
Well, gee, it's comics. Hey. So your comics, the person who doesn't know, Chris brought X-Men back from the dead, basically.
Well, credit where credit is due. The resurrection is the actual responsibility of at the time editor-in-chief Dave Len Wein, working with artist Dave Cockrum, who, at the behest of Len's predecessor, Roy Thomas, basically restructured and... reestablished the team. And the idea with Giant Size number one back in late 74, beginning of 75, was to do a more international series rather than the four white urban East Coast guys and their redheaded girlfriend. Stan Lee's thought was to try and appeal to a more international audience because Marvel was toying with the idea of doing foreign reprints. So Len, working with Dave Cockrum, who was one of the most brilliant conceptual artists of his time, and probably in current comic book history, only a very, very, very slight step in my eyes below Jack Kirby, created a whole catalog of really cool characters. And Colossus from the steppes of Russia, which then was quite daring since they were Soviet. Aurora from East Africa, Kurt Wagner, Nightcrawler from Germany.
Great character.
I like him. And Thunderbird from the American Southwest. So we have all these really cool characters, and we got the team together. And then Len went freelance and didn't have time. He had to give up one title in the process, and what he chose to give up was the bi-monthly X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me if I was interested in writing it, and...
But at that point, it wasn't doing that well, X-Men.
Wasn't doing anything because it had just been relaunched.
Oh,
the
okay.
Giant Size number one had just appeared.
Oh, that's 74, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what became issues 94 and 95 was actually Giant Size number two.
Yeah, all the comic book fans out there are throwing like popcorn at me as I say these stupid things.
Not stupid, it's just...
Unaware.
We are talking 40 years?
Yeah.
We're talking the mid-20th century.
Yes.
Plus or minus, you know. We're talking the era when TARDISes were popping up in the Oval Office, when mutants were landing on...
No TARDIS popped up in the Oval Office until the 21st century.
You obviously weren't watching the program. Matt Smith and his team appeared
Well, okay, I mean, time travel, Days of Future Past allowed, but I'm thinking in terms of chronology.
Oh, you're thinking in terms of external technology.
Yes.
Well, for those of us who actually work in the business, there is no external technology. There is but life.
Ah.
In some alternate dimension, there must be a real TARDIS, and...
Actually, we're probably inside of it. It's bigger.
The real TARDIS or the real alternate dimension?
No, we're inside the TARDIS.
Which is, in turn, inside a locker inside Men in Black headquarters.
Yes. Yes, that would follow, in a marble.
No, I'm talking... No, this is cinema. Cinema is reality.
Oh, well, yeah, we knew that.
But,
except
anyway, Len moved on and tossed it over to me. And Dave and I just...
Ran with it for, what, 16 years?
Well, no, we ran with it for about a dozen issues, and then Dave sort of had to take a breather. And that's when John Byrne came on with issue 108.
Yes.
Well, 107. No, and, 108 and then 110.
And somebody actually posted on my Facebook page, and I didn't get to read it carefully, but he put a copy of the cover when I announced you were on the air tonight of 108 and said that he met his wife as a result of that issue. Go to my Facebook page, you'll
see. Not my fault.
No, he's very happy about it.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
I think underneath it, he wrote something like Chris Rocks, but anyway.
No, Chris Rock is somebody totally different, and he's much funnier than I can ever be.
Yes. Actually, I like Chris Rock.
I do, too.
But you were at the helm. Now, you see, where I get confused are in all the different X-Men universes. X-Men versus Uncanny X-Men versus all the...
There is... Technically, in my own heart of hearts, there are but... There is one X-Men universe.
Mm.
Those are my stories.
Yes.
Then there is... The other X-Men universe, which is everyone else's stories.
Yeah.
But...
And I turn on the TV, and I see an episode of X-Men, and Wolverine wears a yellow costume, which was hinted at in one of the reviews that I read. You know, with the claws sticking out all the time. The claws were not internal to his hand, and they didn't hurt him when they came out, which is the way you wrote it.
No, actually, it's the way... Dave designed it.
Oh, really?
Len's original conception for Wolverine was that he was actually an adolescent, like the other five members of the original team, and that the claws were embedded in the gloves. they extended out of the housing.
Yeah, you see, that's what I saw on a fairly well animated but not that very interesting X-Men TV cartoon.
I mean, the problem I suppose that Dave and I had with it was, as with Iron Man and his armor, that means anybody could put on the armor, like Rhodey, and boom, he's Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
Or she's Iron Man.
Yeah.
If it was Pepper.
Now, that would be interesting if Downey ever leaves the series, which he, you know, after Avengers 2, he has said he has considered.
Gee, you mean 15 years as one character isn't enough?
No, well, he actually gets to do real movies also, and he's...
And with his cut of the proceeds, is probably allowed to buy real countries.
Mm.
I
met his father, had his father on the air.
That's cool.
I liked his father's films. They were sick.
Well,
Putney Swope, one of my favorites.
Oh, God, no.
Yeah, I see, just mentioning the name.
But
Putney says the V girl has got the half soul. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Better you than me.
What's the matter, Mario? I remember it. I haven't seen this movie in 40 years.
Oh, there you are. That's the key
But I saw it about 40 times.
A brilliant film. You can't get it out of your head.
Yeah, but people who don't know, there are a number of movies of the late 60s, early 70s. I guess Grease's Palace is the best known. With Alan, so that one stars Alan Arbus in a zoot suit. And you would see the credit written and directed by Robert Downey, and then there would be a beat and would say, a prince.
This
is his son, this guy who...
Well, the really weird thing is when he started his acting career, I kept getting him confused with his father.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yep.
Wow. He's a really young guy to make all those great films.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, his father...
goes to show how old a butthead I am.
Yeah. Well, I didn't make that connection immediately.
That I'm not an old butthead?
No, I wasn't thinking that. But at any rate, yes, the suit could make... the superhero, and then what's the point of the superhero? But you see, not that many writers up until the era in which you come into Marvel, and largely through your doing, have much in the way of real internal characters or outreach culturally. You brought in a multicultural aspect before it was in vogue.
It was just cool.
Well, it was.
No, I mean...
But others weren't doing it.
I guess that's why I'm me and they're them.
Well, yes. Okay, fine.
Though I would suspect many of them, like Engelhart, like Gerber, like Len, like Marv, would argue.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends on your perceptions.
Yeah. I mean, it's notable that Marvel allowed you to do this where some other places might not have.
Marvel was, in certain respects, a remarkably laissez-faire organization. I mean, I guess I have the advantage or disadvantage of being one of the last creators still working in-house, working at Marvel, who worked there for Stan when Stan was the active editor in chief. And his attitude, in many respects, was remarkably simple.
This is your book.
It was your book. It was your responsibility.
Mm.
All we want is it needs to be in on time. It needs to... needs to sell issues, and we would like it to be good. Any two out of three were acceptable,
mm-hmm.
But if you could do all three, I'm going to shut up and leave you on your own.
Okay.
Because as editor-in-chief trying to hold this rattle-trap together, he had more important things to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he had the only office with a door.
Right.
And, he took it home with him every night.
And everybody else was in the bullpen.
There were like five or six different offices. The actual.
Now, I was in Neil Adams' office. I remember that in the 70s. In fact, the late Robert Knight, whose time slot we're just out of by 9 minutes, Klain told me when I came into this time slot that he came to WBAI as a result of the fact that Neil had donated 10 posters of Are You Ready? Warp. It's 10 signed Subway-sized posters, and Robert called the phone number, which is now 212-209-2950, and pledged money and came to WBAI and met me. I was the switchboard operator at the time, and I gave him one of the signed Neil Adams posters. I don't have one. I would love to have kept one for myself, but I think we were asking $100 in the 70s for these.
That's a month's wages. Yeah. My God, what I got paid. I got paid $125 a week to be assistant editor, for crying out loud.
Yeah, well, I get paid less for being at WBAI, but
It's worth so much less, you don't notice. I mean,
yeah. I mean, they double my salary every week. If you can do the math.
I remember when I was a kid, like in college, and noticing, oh my God, the federal budget is about to pass $1 billion. This is the era when Everett Dirksen had his famous line, you know, a billion here, a billion there, sooner or later you're talking real money.
Yes.
But, you know, to go around and tell people, yes, someday you'll have average billionaires, and then you'll have real billionaires who have like $40 billion, and then you have companies that are worth like 15%, worth almost $250 billion.
And I just remembered the connection. We had a guy on BAI who I actually knew when I was little, I mean 4 years old, named Frank Heller. Mm-hmm. And he was Krusty Bunker.
Krusty Bunkers were fun.
And he was a Krusty Bunker. And that means what? That he did fill-ins on art?
No, it was Neil's shop.
Yeah. And it was he who got the connection to Neil Adams. When this is a Broadway play. It was a trilogy, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
It was a cult hit in Chicago and played for like 2 or 3 years, came to New York and closed after 8 performances.
Yes, I know. I don't have the poster. I have the playbill.
I have the playbill, and I have it signed by Neil.
Oh, that's cool.
And I really liked the play. There was great stagecraft. It was clever. It was fun. I would have, and today, if they remounted it, any producers listening, it would be huge.
I never quite got over the fact that Neil's cover young lady was so much better looking than the reality.
Well, Broadway versus comic book cover, you know.
Reality versus comic book cover.
Well,
I mean,
yes,
you know,
there you go.
Legs that went from here to there and back again in the days before there was Julia Roberts.
Yep. But then you made Storm.
He's
nodding for people. Dave made Storm.
Dave made Storm. I just stood on the sidelines and went, holy cow.
You wrote her when you saw her. Let's put it that way.
I tried my best.
Yeah. And you did your best. She's a great character.
But actually, to bounce back 10 minutes, the coolest, weirdest moment in those early issues is X-Men 99, I think. Or, yeah, 99. When everybody's prisoners on board the Star Corps shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
The space station, not the shuttle. And, sorry, this is 98, not 99.
Right.
And they're trying to figure out how they can get free of their bonds, and Logan just pops his claws, and Jean looks at him aghast and says, your claws, they're real. And Logan just looks at her and says, yeah. And, you know, I think Gene does, or Banshee does, what everybody in the audience should be doing at that point, going, ugh!
Yeah, exactly.
But I remember when Dave first came in with the sketch, and it was like, that was awful. I'm sitting there looking at it and going, ugh! They come right out of his hand. That is so gross. That is so wonderful. Let's do it.
And talk about Marvel and its propensity for inner pain. This is physical pain every time those suckers come out.
Oh, he's slashing open his hand.
Yeah.
You know, thank God he has a healing factor. Yeah. Otherwise, he'd be really screwed.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, he doesn't have one anymore. He's really screwed.
That's right.
You know, so...
Went back and forth in that one, yeah.
Well, I think that was one of the seminal things I was playing with Logan throughout my run, especially...
Logan's run.
Da-dump. Especially as I got towards the end and I was doing this extended arc where he was dying.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to lead up to a really, really cool storyline where I was going to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, notice how everything old is new again?
Mm-hmm.
You know, kill Charlie, kill Logan, you know.
Well, especially nowadays in TV where they'll kill anybody.
Oh, I wasn't thinking at all about TV.
And movies. Yeah, but I mean, it's become de rigueur. You were ahead of the pack then. And
well, I kept getting told, no, I couldn't do this. I couldn't kill Wolverine because he was too important. I couldn't. Obviously, we couldn't kill Jean because, you know...
Oh, for Christ's sake, they killed Superman, you know.
Oh, that was long after us.
Yeah, I know. But I'm saying
here's
comics.
No. This is the flip side of the story. So, DC happily kills Superman.
Yeah.
You know, big event. It's gets press all over the place.
Sells issues.
We're over in London for... Oh, gosh. Can't even remember which convention, but it was a... Eagle Awards or something in London. And Jeanette Kahn, the publisher, is going out to dinner with a bunch of her editors, and it's a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Her phone rings. Her mobile rings. It's Steve Ross. Now, you know, she's president of DC Comics, but he's chairman of the board
mm-hmm.
and president of Time Warner. We're not talking small potatoes. Oh, yes. And he's dying of cancer.
Oh, my God.
And the phone rings. And it's Steve. And he's pissed. He's furious. Why? Why the F? What were you thinking of when you killed Superman? And she's like, well, it was a really cool idea. Good plot. No. You don't understand. This is Superman. We are Time Warner. Superman is a linchpin of the Time Warner reality.
Right.
You do not do anything like this with Superman without running it up the chain to my office and have me sign off on it.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently it was a much longer and more involved conversation, and she got very pale, did not go to dinner, and flew back to New York like 24 hours later.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what happened happened. But the revelation was, oh, holy crumb cakes. People in the real world pay attention? That up till then there was, I think, a lot of people in comics lived in a belief system that let us all believe that what we did had no effect outside of our little fiefdom.
Bubbleverse, yeah.
Or bubbleverse,
yeah.
You know. And it wasn't true.
Yeah, especially not with Superman.
But who knew? It was Superman. The book wasn't even selling, for crying out loud. That's why they killed him off.
Yeah, well, people took it for granted that there will always be. They knew it was there.
Well, people in comics knew for a drop-dead certainty Yeah, he's dead. Yeah, and the sun will rise in the morning.
I actually had a pool going online on a BBS on when was the first issue of Superman back from the dead appear?
Ah, but you see, the fallacy is we live in the bubbleverse of, for want of a better term, fandom.
Yes.
The problem with Jeanette was it was such a good story.
Mm-hmm.
It was so convincing. It got so much press that took it absolutely seriously that everyone thought, oh, my God, you've killed Superman.
But that's the gag.
No.
People took it seriously.
But they didn't take it as a gag. They took it as reality. They thought he's never going to come back.
Yeah, I know. It's like, hello.
Well, we can say hello from the perspective of the 21st century, but...
Oh, in the 20th century, you could say, oh, for God's sake, it's a comic book. You can, you know, that you've killed off this character here. How many times, you know, in 21st century, how many times in season 5, or more properly, I think it was season 28 of Doctor Who, did they kill Rory? Four times.
Are we talking as a human or as a robot animatronic?
The character.
Or as a robot animatronic that the Doctor casually, between episodes, turned into a human again?
Right.
I'd like to have seen that one. Actually,
knowing Moffitt, maybe they will.
My response to you is Reichenbach Falls.
Yes.
Because...
Absolutely.
Conan Doyle, you know...
He was unable to do it. He really...
No, he did it. And then they wouldn't let him...
But he really wanted to kill off...
Holmes.
Another Robert Downey.
It's... The whole point was you sometimes want to separate yourself from your creations and get on with your life. And this is where the real world... that is in love with your stuff won't let you.
And they're paying for it.
As Bobby Ewing found out to his chagrin.
Yes, exactly. So let me take a moment.
And Leonard Nimoy, for that matter.
That's right. Absolutely.
On the other hand, didn't turn out so badly in the end.
No, it worked. I thought they did that with finesse. And I still think that number two was, for terms of pure enjoyment, the best of the lot.
Well, the real challenge will be, can new Star Trek version 3 exist without a Leonard Nimoy cameo? Or will they yield to the temptation yet again?
Yeah, because he's still around. He's still working. He's doing more voice work than anything else. I understand.
That was all pretty much he did in the second one.
Yeah. He's not in the best of health.
He wasn't that young when I was watching original Star Trek, and that was a while ago.
That's right. I mean, he'd been working in Hollywood for 20 years at that point something like that.
On the other hand, you and I aren't that young either, so...
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, I should speak for myself. I'm not that young anymore.
No, I hit 70, so...
I don't like to say... You young whippersnapper.
Yes, exactly. But the point being... What was my point? I wanted to take a break.
I
wanted to remind people that they're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial WBAI in New York City at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org, streaming or broadcasting, depending on what device you are using. And...
We're broadcasting from Uptown Wednesday night.
Uptown, exactly. With a capital U, we're in Harlem at CCNY in sort of the middle part of an otherwise inside wonderful building. This used to be Lewisohn Stadium where we are. This was Lewisohn Stadium. In fact, Janet Coleman of WBAI told me that what they did was they took Lewisohn Stadium, picked it up, and turned it upside down That's this building. Thing.
The architecture is really, really cool.
It's not inside.
No, outside.
No, actually, no. Other parts of this building, it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, the things that I see around the campus are wonderful. And this is actually a very lovely area.
But this is the computer geek level. It's supposed to look like computer geek level.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. But being a listener-sponsored station, we need listeners to sponsor the station. And the best way to do that is by pledging all of $10 a month. It's what's called a BAI buddy. And a lot of people are asked, you know, raise this amount of money on your show, raise that amount of money on the show. Our station manager recognizes that at this hour, we're not going to make tons of money. But I recognize that a lot of people listening right now are listening in the middle of the afternoon on the podcast, on the archive. And so you can do this any number of ways. One way or the other, we would like you to call area code 212-209-2950 or go to WBAI.org. There's another address for directly pledging that I don't care to give because it's almost, it's give the number two WBAI.org. It's like, you know, you can't say give to WBAI.org because if somebody puts in that T-O. Let me just say, I think that if you have Norton or any kind of web browser that will stop you from going to certain kinds of sites, it will pop up, and it's certainly not safe for work, okay? So just go to WBAI.org, drop down the various things that say you want to give money, choose the BAI buddy, and for your favorite radio show, choose Hour of the Wolf. On the air soon on WBAI since, God help me, 1972 when Margot Adler started and I've been the host since mid-1974. So,
because who knows, if you don't support it, Hour of the Wolf might turn into Hour of the Dire Wolf, and you really don't want those puppies to get angry with you.
Yeah, and the situation here is dire indeed. So, 212-209-2950, that's the easiest thing. Operators are standing by. And we actually, nowadays, you know, we don't have this room filled with volunteers. We have a specialist office that takes care of these things. No premiums. The premium is the program, as they sometimes say. And that doesn't work all the time, but hey, come on. We've got Chris Claremont here, who's one of the superstars of comics, who's writing of, it's true, whose writing of X-Men has, you in essence, not paid a penny, but you wrote, what, 5 out of the 7 films? Is that a correct figure? I should say, wrote the original of what became 7 films.
You can find my fingerprints all over every one of them.
That's true. Absolutely true.
And if you're not careful, sneaking into Iron Man 2, ooh, Guardians of the Galaxy.
Still to come. Yes.
Still to come. I think a little bit of Avengers.
I think a little bit of Avengers, yes.
I get around frighteningly.
Yeah, it's
I frighteningly get around.
Yeah, and the X-Men movies have been of varying quality. I had major issues with Wolverine origin, starting with the fact that his father became his brother. You wrote it.
Hugh Jackman said 3 of my signature lines. I'm not going to say a bad word about anything. I was sitting there kind of going, woohoo.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah, but
Sabretooth is my guy.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know,
But it's like a scene out of Chinatown. She's my daughter. She's my sister. You know, whap, whap on each one. He's my father. He's my brother.
There's a very simple, fundamental, basic way of looking at this. Thanks in large measure to the work of producer Lauren Shuler Donner. I have had the ridiculous, and boy, it is ridiculous, good fortune to see characters that I've either created or been associated with or defined, portrayed by a list of some of the finest actors of the current generation.
And some good directors.
And I'm actually just going by the faces.
Yeah.
At this point. You know, the giggle description is, we got two Ks. Probably a potential K. That's Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart. And wouldn't be surprised if Hugh Jackman ended up there sooner or later.
That's three Ks.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
Two actual, one potential.
Yes.
We got two winners of the Best Actress Oscar.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Halle Berry and...
Jennifer Lawrence. Everyone forgets. She actually did some work besides Hunger Games and X-Men. We've got Best Supporting Actress in Anna Paquin. Best Supporting Actor in Ian McKellen.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. That's all he's ever been nominated for.
Well, not leaving aside, you know, Emmys and...
Yeah, and BAFTA Awards and Olivier Awards.
Oh, sorry, we've got a winner of an Olivier Best Actor, Hugh Jackman.
What, Oklahoma?
You betcha.
Oh, good guess.
It was a bright golden haze on the meadow.
Yeah.
And he wrote...
And he went
from Oklahoma to Wolverine in one transatlantic jump.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing.
You've got a Best Supporting Actor Emmy for Peter Gingrich.
Mm-hmm.
You run down the list.
I'm trying to remember where I first saw
Peter Gingrich.
James McAvoy did a British miniseries that was great, a suspense series that was turned into an American movie starring Russell Crowe, and his role was replaced by a girl. I'm trying to remember that he's
this is the one with Matt Damon. Not Matt Damon, sorry, Superman. New Batman. Ben Affleck.
Yes. He was in it. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember the British series better.
Yeah.
The 6-hour version versus the 2-hour. And McAvoy was the Cub reporter in the original.
Oh, that's very cool.
Where the young lady was, and Bill Nighy was the editor of the paper as opposed to Helen Mirren, the head of the...
You take your Bill Nighy, you take your Helen Mirren, you know.
Yeah. So that's where I first saw McAvoy, and
everybody,
it's known, knows Kevin Bacon. I'm two jumps. Never met him.
Ah, but I wrote Magneto. I created Sebastian Shaw.
That's right.
Sebastian Shaw was played by Kevin Bacon, so I'm 1.5 steps removed.
There you go. Now, so what has been, talk as frankly or as crisply as you like, your reactions to the movies themselves? Watching, and let's point, we need to point out to listeners that basically what you have done that has earned, I don't know how many billions of dollars just in the X-Men universe.
Mm-hmm.
you've been paid zip because it's in essence work for hire, and you don't own the characters that you've created.
Marvel owns them, but thanks to the vagaries of licensing, Fox controls the cinema, the TV and cinema media license.
Yeah, but you got paid your salary for doing the books.
And just like every other, it's the same situation that virtually every other writer or artist in modern comic history is familiar with.
Exactly. I mean, obviously going back to Siegel and Schuster, you know, 1941.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so and they only saw money posthumously. Their families finally started, and that's not over yet. Apparently.
The problem? No, it's not. Look, you know, when Dave Cockrum and I started working on the X-Men in 1975, I don't think any of us figured the industry would be around in 5 years.
Yeah, right.
The numbers were just...
You said that on this radio show more than once.
Well, it was true.
And, yeah, but...
I had the disadvantage of being there watching it happen.
But you also said that in the 80s and in the 90s.
Oh, no. No, in the 80s, it was a totally different... Once the direct market came into play, and especially for the first 10 years or so when Marvel had the brilliance of holding on to the newsstand, the newsagent distribution,
right,
as well as the direct market, so that we not only had a constant influx of new readers who were snagged just by walking by and picking up a copy that was on the newsstand at the airport or wherever. But from our perspective, that gave the X-Men a ridiculous advantage because we made our nut. We paid off the print costs off of newsstand. The direct market was all gravy. That was, whoa.
Okay.
We are so cool. So...
And there were a lot of titles at that time.
Not really.
No?
Up until the last third of the 80s, the X-Men universe was basically me writing X-Men and New Mutants.
Yeah, I actually meant when I say there were a lot of titles, Marvel had a lot of titles.
We had about 50.
Yeah.
That's not a lot.
How many are there today?
From what I keep reading about Overstreet Monthly, you could see 200 or 300.
Really?
If not 500 at the peak, back in the late 90s.
No, but today?
I would say probably a couple of hundred, 300.
That many titles?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I hadn't realized.
Well, the difficulty is, for me being, if you'll pardon the expression, an old fart. Sorry, can you say that?
What, fart? I don't think so.
Okay, sorry. An old...
My button's all the way over there. I can reach it if I have.
An old flubberdubber.
No, that's a word you can't use on the internet. Nobody can say flubberdubber.
Dang.
Yeah.
But,
got the list somewhere.
You know, it just... You know, it was... I can't keep track of them all.
Yeah.
And everything's being rebooted. It's being, you know, they're scrambling all the structures of, you know, Uncanny Avengers, Amazing X-Men, Fantastic Defenders.
Yeah. They're all in a blender at that point.
Well, It's a different publishing philosophy. Stan,
but they also now have to worry about the movies. My understanding is that at this time, no Avenger shall appear in X-Men. No X-Men shall cross over to Avengers without some major rethinking of where the whole Avengers series is going.
Well, I think the frustration from Marvel as a publisher comes from the fact that the success of the Avengers movies are totally divorced from the success or failure of the X-Men comic book.
Yeah, and they
and
have,
if you enthusiastically push the X-Men as a concept or, and as a franchise, the benefit will accrue to Fox. Whereas if you focus on the Avengers, if you focus on the Inhumans, let us say,
mm-hmm.
that benefit is exclusively to Marvel and Marvel Disney.
Yeah.
I guess Spider-Man is in flux at this point.
Yeah.
Or not.
Yeah. But I mean, the notable difference between the two is, to get back to auteur theory, is you have one person overseeing all the Avengers movies. And
Well, you mean Joss?
Yeah, that's the one. And that helps. Just like the same way on Doctor Who, you have the story runner.
Well, I think in Kevin Feige's case as head of Marvel Studios,
mm-hmm.
I would like to believe that the philosophy is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
Joss has proven that he can do extraordinary work. I mean, $1.6 billion in first release. Holy crumb cakes.
Yeah, but there's one thing, and you were mentioning this in Days of Future Past. One thing that makes the X-Men and Avengers movies different from so many of the others, like the current Superman and all those, is they have giggles. There are some real in the Avengers. There are some real knee-slapping moments. There are great lines. All you mm-hmm. have to do for some people to say shawarma.
Well,
and or the final reveal of Captain America saying Hulk smash, and it was one of the funniest moments in cinema history in the last decade.
Well. Joss has the annoying disadvantage of being a really brilliant writer.
Yeah.
It's
I'm sort of annoyed that he's doing all those for a totally selfish reason, is I want, you know, Serenity 2. I want, you know, Faith or somebody else, the Vampire Slayer. I want more. He's playing in somebody else's playground, which is something that you're familiar with. But he was you know, what he changed the television universe with Buffy. With, if nothing else, the idea that a syndicated program could be such a major hit and so influential, creating what became the CW and that mentality.
But I think the disadvantage is that for all the success of Buffy, and, you know, it drives me crazy because I've got a box set sitting on my shelf at home that even after 4 years, I still haven't had time to even look at one of them, let alone the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I used to watch the series with tremendous enthusiasm.
Some of it was brilliant. Some of Dollhouse was brilliant.
Oh, you got me there, I'm afraid, because
again, they broadcast them incorrectly.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I think part of it is,
and that's
that no matter how successful one is as a writer or director, sooner or later you run into the realities of the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And the TV marketplace is as unforgiving in its own way as the comic book publishing marketplace is in its. And as it is as controlling in its own way.
Yeah.
You know, you are, whatever you might want to do as a writer, you are responsible to the showrunners. The showrunners are responsible to the producers. The producers presumably are responsible to the network.
And then the network just changes stuff without ever talking to the producers.
Well, I think the network's attitude is it's our money.
Yeah.
You know, they know best.
Yeah, but they don't. They killed Firefly because they ran like episode 4 first before the pilot episode. They didn't show, and then they didn't even run the last 2 episodes, the penultimate episode was one of the best of the entire series. And you look back on that, and yes, there are dull moments and all that, but it picks up speed. I trust Whedon shows even Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which ended up in a really interesting place.
Well, I have to honestly confess that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. had a, for me, was up against a deal breaker, NCIS. I mean, I've been a fan of Donald Belisario's work as a producer since, I really don't want to say Battlestar Galactica, but, you know, it's a good long while.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I find most exciting and surprising about his work is that even when you have a show that's been on for 8 years,
mm-hmm.
the characters in many respects are still fresh. He's not afraid to mix it up. In this instance, with the departure of Ziva and the introduction of the NSA blonde,
mm-hmm.
who, forgive me, whose name I can't remember. You know, things happen.
We've got to get you a DVR. You know.
Well, the last season closer with the death of, remarking on the death of Gibbs' father. Mm-hmm. I mean that. It was a nice TV moment.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
my disadvantage was turning on the one episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is when their ridiculously huge, I don't even know what it is anymore, a 767 or you know.
They call it the bus.
When the bus crashes.
Yes.
And they're fighting a creature who's pan-dimensional and only comes out in the dark, so the entire show looks like it was basically filmed before they remembered to pay the electric bill.
Mm-hmm.
And conceptually, I'm sure it felt like a brilliant idea, but watching it on my flat screen, it was like, I can't see what's going on. I'm going to change the channel now.
It wasn't that bad on my 40-incher, but it was a show like many Whedon shows, even though this one is Jed Whedon and wife, with Joss executive producing. It took its time getting going, but it got going, and it ended strong.
Well, good. I'm glad of that.
Very strong.
I'll catch it on.
And one of the dead people shows up in the last episode.
Oh, for God's sake! That trick never works.
Yeah, right. Well,
I should know. I've done it more than enough times.
Yeah, and I haven't even seen. And I really should. Captain America 2.
Well, Captain America 2 was a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, it continues in Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Well, the thing I have to say, though, is...
But they didn't
I've been to Washington. Mm-hmm. I've looked at the Potomac. I want to know how you got 3 underground top secret hangars for the new generation of helicarriers. Not to mention parking for all the staff who was building that silly stuff.
You're always coming up with that stuff. It's great.
Well, I mean, it's... If they'd set it out by, I don't know,
It's funny, because before you were talking about the Bubbleverse, and now you're thinking in realistic terms, I remember you and I, at the time that Star Trek Next Gen was on, having a conversation, and it was my favorite show, and I was praising it, and you were saying, there are supposed to be some 1,100 crew members on board. Where are the families? Where are the kids? Where's the daycare center? And all that, and I thought, geez,
who cleans the toilets?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they finally did shows about the kids.
A couple. There were nods and winks, but that was, you know, in the season.
But...
didn't start till season
The funny
five.
Thing was, what I love...
I may have heard you on the air.
What I loved more, though, about Enterprise as a series as opposed to Star Trek was, since it was only late 21st century, they got to wear real clothes.
Yes.
I mean, oh my God, it's like Archer's wearing jeans. And I would, I'm sorry. It's like... everybody on the Enterprise has to wear zoot suits. Oh, for goodness sakes. There really needs to be a tad more practical inventiveness in terms of science fiction costumes.
Yes, that would be nice.
I mean, looking at the movie reiteration of Star Trek, you know, the J.J. Abrams versions, that was a much more embraceable reality.
Yes, it was. His stories suck, but you can't look at them too closely. The movies are so much fun to watch.
They killed off Thor in the first scene, man. That's uncool. I mean, he went on to a better place. He went to Asgard and came back as the God of Thunder, but buff.
Well, they killed off Mickey from Doctor Who in the second movie right in the beginning. How many people even noticed that?
Mickey?
Mickey. Rose Tyler's boyfriend.
Oh, is he the husband?
He is the husband. He is the one who blows up Federation headquarters, and here's a trivia question.
It wasn't Federation headquarters, it was their Black Ops file storage area.
Right. But here's the...
And I didn't even pay attention during the damn movie.
Here's a trivia question that I love.
Oh, actually, wait. One quick one in return.
Yes.
You would think, after all this time, you know... after God knows how many stupid movies, someone would think, maybe we shouldn't put the conference room on the outside of the building. Maybe we should put it somewhere, I don't know, safe?
Uh-huh.
Like outer space. Sorry. You were saying.
Trivia question. Where is Starfleet headquarters located?
You mean San Francisco?
Well, it's a part of San Francisco.
You mean on Marin? It's on the north. It's over. It's just south of Ape City.
They say it in two movies. Pacifica. Pacifica, Berkeley, where this radio station was founded, or where this network was founded.
No. I've seen The View. They're not. They're on the north.
I don't know about The View.
They're north.
In the movie.
They're north and, frighteningly, I think, north and west of the Golden Gate.
But they mention it. They mention it in the episode where Picard decides to grow grapes again for his wine thing. And they
mention that's it next
in one of the
generation, no, for no, goodness
and,
sakes.
And it is mentioned in the second J.J. Abrams movie.
Oh, well, you know.
And it's mentioned in number 4 of the Save the Whales movie.
Boy, those whales sure do get around.
Yeah, they do. They certainly do. Let me just remind people, speaking of Pacifica, that this is WBAI in New York City and WBAI.org. And this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Chris Claremont. I need to promote two events. A week coming into New York next week are two notable events. One is BEA, the Booksellers Expo of America. I expect, by the way, to be working at a table there, Science Fiction Writers of America, as a volunteer.
Oh.
But on the... I usually do. But on the Friday, which is to say next Friday, May 30th, okay, at the same time as BEA are the Audie Awards, A-U-D-I-E, for audiobooks.
Cool.
And two people that I work with, Stefan Rudnicki and Gabriel DeCure of Skyboat Media, that do everything from full cast dramas, 60 actors, I think, for Ender's Game Alive. They made a little movie with Harlan Ellison recently, in the last year. It's on YouTube.
Wait. They made an Ender's Game movie with Harlan Ellison?
No, they... No.
Because I was thinking that would look very interesting with Harrison Ford.
No, they did a radio drama, an audio drama,
called
Ender's Game Alive with some 60 actors.
And Harlan Ellison.
I don't think he and Scott would get along.
I don't either. That's why I was very intrigued.
Yeah. But at any rate, but Harlan has been consistent with his politics through the years. Scott has not. Scott has gone into some dark place. But he wasn't there when he was on this show when the day he won the Nebula Award for Speaker for the Dead. He wasn't in the place where he is now. And I think he killed his own franchise. There could have been a Speaker for the Dead movie if he'd have just kept his mouth shut. But anyway.
Well, one could postulate that Speaking for the Dead has a consequence.
No, there you go.
But that's getting way too Indie Jones.
Anyway, the people that do that, they do the Lightspeed magazine podcasts, mm-hmm. that are edited from the magazine, edited by John Joseph Adams. And the podcasts are hosted and edited by, me.
Yay!
Yay. Yeah, some actual audiobook work there, or podcast work anyway. And it's wonderful to be working with such professional actors. And they've worked with Will Wheaton and all kinds of fun people. They've done a novel by John Scalzi. In fact, I think that's the Will Wheaton connection there.
He's actually got a show coming up, I think, on Sci-Fi?
I have heard rumors, yeah.
It looks like fun.
Yeah, who knows?
About bloody time.
Well, sci-fi is trying to introduce the concept of putting science fiction onto the sci-fi channel, which is...
Oh, you don't think World Wrestling Federation counts?
No, not quite. That's fantasy.
Good point. Okay, I'll concede that one.
At any rate, Stefan and Gabrielle, the people who are Skyboat Media, are going to do a special edition of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which Chris has read for. They are going to perform on Friday, May 30th, in a new venue for us, because our normal venue is booked in advance by Gallery Lala, Artisans Market.
Cool.
It's very cool, actually. It's a really lovely market. Even though it's edging us out to an extent, or edging us downstairs. We're going to be doing readings downstairs. So, for more information, I'm going to send out a mailing tomorrow. But it's already up on Facebook. Join the NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction, readings group. And you can find out about that event. 4 days later, we will have our normal event at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, a.k.a. Gallery Lala, at 138 Sullivan Street. And Gregory Frost and Tom Doyle will be the readers. So
brilliant.
So we got two really... Admission is free. Donations encouraged. So two very cool events. I thought I might see you at the Robert Sheckley event we did, if only because... we had his daughter Alyssa Quitney, who's dabbled in your industry. She was editor of Vertigo.
Ah, sorry.
Sit
back and think. My industry is which one now?
Comics. She co-wrote two Sandman books.
What, Neil let somebody else write it?
Yep.
Zut alors.
I think, you know, he oversaw it and all that, but she did it, and she's a wonderful writer on her own. And we had her and her mother, Ziva Quitney, who was Sheckley's second wife and editor, I would say, in the good years. In other words,
cool.
She was with Sheckley from 1954, just the year after I was born, through about 1973.
Young punk.
And as far as Sheckley's writing is concerned, which I adore Sheckley, those are the good years. And we had a great time with them and Michael Swanwick and Henry Wessels. And then last month we did a play by Andrea Hairston called, guess what, Thunderbird. And yes, there is a connection. Being the, you know, the sort of trickster god kind of thing Southwest. You mentioned it yourself.
No. See, you're thinking of, you think of your Thunderbird. I was thinking of the Thunderbirds.
Oh, no.
You kidding? That was cool.
Yeah, but
Thunderbirds are go.
But that's not Andrea Hairston, okay? That's not multicultural.
No, it's not, but it was...
theater, science fiction theater.
Yes, real actors looking just like puppets. Real puppets looking just like actors.
Yeah, well, these were actually real actors, some of them looking like puppets, because there were masks and there wasn't puppetry involved in our little production. It was a staged reading. Those going to ReaderCon, by the way, there'll be another performance. But we've been on a roll. We've done some really fun, cool events of late.
Brilliant.
And we've got two coming up in the next fortnight. So, how much you wrote Days of Future Past as an arc?
It was two issues.
It was only two issues?
Back in the day... Okay.
Yeah.
Back in the day when we wrote with pen on paper and had to turn in typewritten manuscripts. And if we wanted to get them copied, see, in my bad accent, I'm telling you this here.
We had more Chicago than Brooklyn.
That's right. Hey, you know, if John Stewart can do it, you know.
John Stewart can't do it is the problem.
Well, neither could I.
Okay.
So,
you should be on his show. You really should.
Sha. Well, we were, Beth and I were once. We were in the audience. Ba-dum boom. But anyway. What was the question again?
It was approaching...
Oh, Days of Future Past, that's
yes,
right.
Yes, it was approaching. What did you... You saw the movie last night.
No. My point was...
two issues.
When I was... During my first run on the X-Men, Stan's... The attitude at Marvel, the philosophy was... two issues and out. I mean, think of... Here's the case in point. The arc that got me back into comics when I quit because I was in high school and you didn't read that sort of foolishness was The Coming of Galactus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Coming of Galactus. You got the first issue. The Watcher shows up and says, Galactus is coming. And just to emphasize the point, the Silver Surfer shows up.
Right.
And there's a fight. The next issue, Galactus shows up. and basically beats the living daylights out of everybody and is about to destroy the world. And we're left with a cliffhanger. Can the FF save the world? The next issue, they save the world.
Surprise.
But they don't even take the whole issue to do it.
Hmm.
They save the world by, like, about page 12, maybe page 14, and the last five pages of the book are Johnny Storm going to college. And that was put on the cover. Johnny Storm, this issue.
Wow.
Johnny Storm goes to college. Because defeating the Eater of Worlds and saving the entire planet wasn't enough.
Yeah, now you got to go to school.
But exactly. Which, when you think about it, is a remarkably cool thing as a publishing statement.
I guess
but
so.
The,
yeah.
The rule of thumb was one issue, two issue if it's really good, two and a half if you're pushing it and you need a setup, but don't go out of that. So if you look at, ideally, if you look at the entire run, we did many arcs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, The Dark Phoenix arc was a year.
That's
but it was
right.
a year subdivided into two-parters and one-parter.
Yes.
And maybe a three-parter with the last issue being a double issue at the close. Or actually, the setup was two issues and then the close was a double issue. But the point was you get on, you say your piece, you get off. We followed Dark Phoenix with a two-parter of the X-Men versus Wendigo.
Right.
And then we had Days of Future Past.
That's when it
And then John closed out, John, you know, our team-up closed out with Kitty being attacked by a demon in the mansion at Christmas time. You know, but we did one issue, we did two issues. The idea behind this being that if you have a FUBAR, you can correct it instantly. You're not locked into the beginning of a four-issue story arc that crosses over with 10 other series, creating a 25-issue mega event that will be summed up with three deluxe annuals.
Right.
Which is the current philosophy. And, you know, the argument can be made either way, that the success breeds more success. But in our case, I think the vision was, the hope was, not only do you have really good stories, but at the end of the story, you finish it by leaving the audience going, ah, what the hell happens next? I got to see next issue. Boom.
Yeah.
Which is by far the more, for me anyway, the more desirable outcome than perhaps having the audience sit down and say, I'll wait for the trade.
Yeah, right.
So because I look at it from the old perspective of, trades are only guaranteed if you sell out the original title.
Mm.
If you don't sell out the original title, there's
They're
no guarantee
gonna
you're going to have a trade.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need to push both sides of the equation as hard as possible.
How much of your story did you find in this movie? And do you get any credit outside of acting?
I think you'll have to go see the movie to answer that question. My eyes kind of blurred over towards the end of the credits.
No, I don't mean closing credits. I mean, well, I guess there only are closing credits nowadays.
Yes.
I miss old style, you know, ending with directed by credits. I like opening credits as opposed to simply waiting for a moment, putting the splash logo on the screen and moving on.
This is Brian's...
This is the way everybody
It's the way he does it.
It's the way Whedon does it. It's the way even small films do it.
Well,
now.
You don't want to...
Local
in a way, you don't want to... You want to get the audience on the edge of their seat as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Leave the credits for when everybody's leaving.
So, at any rate, how much of what you wrote is there?
The basic story is John's and my basic story.
Yeah.
I mean, the most fundamental difference is it's Logan who goes back in time, not Kitty.
Right.
And the reason is, from the cinematic point of view, is altogether quite sensible.
I don't know. I wouldn't.
She doesn't exist in the past. It's right. Before she was born. Uh-huh. Therefore, you can't switch her. The comic,
yes,
had the advantage.
Ellen Page is older than she looks, but anyway.
Doesn't matter. Kitty doesn't exist.
Yes,
in,
right,
in 19,
right, yes.
1972,
yeah.
73.
Watergate era. Isn't it?
We're right in the middle of it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, you know.
I know where I was. I was sitting basically where I'm sitting now. In front of the microphone, the hearings were going on, and I did station breaks once an hour. 12 hours a day.
I was going to auditions.
For Watergate? Cool.
No, for acting.
Oh, okay.
No, not for Watergate.
Yeah.
There's
a lot of acting in that.
Yeah.
By the way, we only have, in theory, 20 minutes left.
Zoot the lore, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm
so don't be sorry. It's been wonderful. But I thought I would give listeners the opportunity to talk to Chris Claremont by dialing area code 212-209-2900. If you want to call to pledge, it's 2950, but 212-209-2900 if our phone system is working. There's a horrible, horrible buzz in our system. There's always something that is wrong. Apparently, in the last week, in the middle of the day, we were simply had dead air for 10 minutes. And I suspect it's because that door over there, when it locks, few people have the key. So if you leave and close that door mm-hmm. and the show ends, and it's a pre-recorded show, dead air.
I figure it's Romulans.
Well, old or new. But anyway,
mm-hmm.
I would have been stunned if we hadn't gotten any
calls. Oh, somebody's there?
Somebody's there. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
It's our one listener on the
John Stewart.
Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning.
Mr. Claremont.
Yeah.
Sorry, I tuned in late. I dozed off. And I just got to you about 15 minutes ago.
It's quite all right.
Do you recommend the film?
What, Days of Future Past?
Future Past.
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. It's that rare exception, to my eye anyway, for a summer film. It's actually a film that's about something.
saying a lot.
My first.
I like that.
So summer movies are traditionally check your brain at the door.
my first reaction at looking at it was, this is a November film. Not for fun.
Not a summer movie. Yeah.
I mean it. It's a superhero movie, so it's a summer movie, but in terms of theme, in terms of script, in terms of performance, in terms of...
The special effects not taking the movie over.
The special effects are actually They serve the story, but they're secondary to the quality of the story and quality of the acting. And there are some heartbreaking moments in it. And I think... And some honest-to-goodness surprises.
And
so I don't take my saying it's a November movie as a criticism. It's just there is a lot more meat on this bone, to form the cliche, than one would be used to expect in purely summer fare. And I hope that is to the audience's delight and the filmmaker's benefit.
Well, I, you know, if hopefully it's got a good storyline and a good plot.
And it's gotten good reviews so far from the magazines that review things early, like The Hollywood Reporter and Variety.
Well, it's certainly derived from a good story, and I think they've served it very, very, very well.
What was your thought, and I'm saying this because a couple of nights ago, my housemate told me that they were running on FX, the X-Men First Class.
Well, yeah.
What did you think of that particular film?
Hey, they used my Blackbird, man. I thought that was the coolest thing ever. I walked into the set in at Pinewood in England.
That was at Pinewood? Cool.
Yeah. And I saw the Blackbird hanging from the ceiling, and I remember asking Brian if I could, you know, just take it home and try to figure out how I could fit it in the carry-on.
But Brian didn't direct.
He produced it.
Oh, he produced it.
Now, a couple of quick character things I want to ask you about. Kitty, what is her superhero designation again?
Last time I looked in the comic, she was Shadow Cat.
Shadow Cat, yes, okay. Tell me about Magneto. I have a reason for asking. My housemate...
He's really tall.
Well, I'm curious...
Great voice.
I'm curious about his ethnic derivation. Is
he
Gypsy or is he Jewish?
Actually, he's English.
He's English.
Haven't you ever listened to Ian McKellen?
Yes.
Or Michael Fassbender? They're both ridiculously English.
Yeah. Whatever they were minority and concentration camp.
Yeah,
I know the clear implication is made.
I believe that he and Wolverine first met, I believe, in Poland during World War II, if my memory serves me right.
Not in any story I wrote.
Okay, well.
Which is sort of definitive. Yeah.
No, Logan and Captain America met.
Oh.
Rescuing... the Black Widow, who's a lot, doing pretty well for a lady of serious age, in the comic books, that is. It was clearly established in X-Men 1 and essentially reestablished in First Class that his Magneto's derivation is Jewish and European.
Okay.
Presumably Eastern European.
It's
whatever. It's bad enough.
Auschwitz was an equal opportunity slaughtering. Yeah.
Destroyer. Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
So what happens?
We don't have a lot of time.
Okay.
And there are other calls.
Bye.
Okay.
Take care.
And hold on. And good morning. You're on the air. Turn down your radio. We're on delay here.
Hello.
Chris Claremont.
Yep.
I just want to say thank you for all the stuff that you wrote me. Like I'm 42. A lot of people growing up wish could live in the X-Men mansion with all the. Mutants, et cetera, et cetera. And just want to thank you for everything you did.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
And I wish... I just got to ask you one thing. I'm getting off. I want to let people get a chance. This is great, man. Jim Owsley for Crazy Magazine took Death of Phoenix and rewrote it. It was pretty funny. I always want to know what you thought of that, because they did a little comic piece where you blow his brains out, if you remember that.
Okay.
You don't remember?
I'm lucky sometimes if I can remember yesterday.
Okay.
And at this hour of the morning, all bets are off.
When he blew his brains out, was it a straight shooter?
No, it was a revolver. He's like, my name's Claremont.
Never mind.
Oh, God, that one. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
it's like if you can't laugh, you have no business being in the business.
But, you know, like, people, like, were writing, like, letters and stuff, like, how dare you make fun of Jean Grey, you know, the Phoenix, blah, blah, blah. But I want someone else to get a chance. Thank you so much for everything, man.
You're more than welcome.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Actually, the secret answer to that is, since I know the ultimate fate of Jean Grey, or my Jean Grey, I have the last laugh.
That's right. That's yeah, it's absolutely true. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Hello?
Hello. Turn down your radio, please.
And they're off.
Got confused and they turned off their phone.
Oh, they're back. Or somebody's back.
Or somebody's back. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
Hello?
Hello. How y'all doing?
I'm doing fine.
Hi, I'd like to ask a question as if Mr. Claremont,
yeah,
you know if the current plans on the Justice League have anything to do with the run that you and John Byrne did in 2004?
I would...
Good question.
Do the current plans for Justice League have anything to do with John's story that I scripted? I would not bet the bank on it. To be honest, I suspect that after how many years, the DC Universe has more than enough potential story arcs and storylines to play with. I also think they've got, since they're just getting started now with principal photography on Superman, Batman United or whatever.
They just released the title like yesterday.
Yeah. They're just starting to shoot that one, and they've got to establish everybody else first. So I suspect we'll probably be doing Hour of the Wolf when we're in our 70s before they get around to figuring out what Justice League's going to be.
Yeah.
So they have an infinite number of titles to choose from,
yeah,
and stories
and
to
adapt. A ways to go before.
And
they...
you never know, in the interim, John could come up with an idea that's even better. I wouldn't put it past him.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for your time. Have a good night.
You too.
Thanks. This is WBAI in New York City. You're listening to Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Chris Claremont of Marvel Comics. And it's 9 minutes before Lister's show is supposed to start, Burn Baby Burn Clapper, and he's usually like an hour early, and, you know, the dreadlocks cleaning the floor on the way in as he, well, actually, he doesn't release them until he gets to the studio.
Cool.
So, geez, I hope that you're going to be on time, Lister, otherwise we're going to be putting on a recording. Unless you want to stay here until 5, I don't...
Just so I get home in time to send the kids off to school.
Yeah, exactly. But the telephone number here at WBAI to talk with Chris Claremont is 212-209-2900. It's become apparent to me that, by the way, we only have two lines working. And what happens is, after it rings something like 4 or 5 times, you get shuffled off into a netherworld.
Cool.
So yeah. One without Loki,
but with Muzak.
Oh well, that would be
that would be torment beyond belief.
Tom Hiddleston with Muzak. That's a...
Oh
scary.
Man, see that. If I had my druthers, I would love to do the mutant Asgard war. With Tom Hiddleston going after Aurora.
Mm-hmm.
That would be fun.
Who knows? That could happen. He certainly looks like he has...
Could only happen in the Fox
universe. Yeah.
Well, no, it would have to be Fox and Disney make friends.
Stranger things have happened. I've seen...
I was thinking, you know, we could send Maleficent over and she could, like, give him a little talk.
There you go. Yeah. Except she's married to Brad Pitt, so...
I see no problem with that. He and George Clooney could, you know, Ocean's 17.
Yeah.
Watch us steal back the mutants.
Well, Soderbergh has resigned, you know. Retired.
Oh, pshaw.
For now. He's doing sculpture.
Well, you know, you could sculpture a mutant here or there.
Yeah,
I think leave a trail.
He didn't say forever, but, you know, it's like, you know, the phase of what he has been doing is done. And he's moving on. And that's not to say that he may not come back. He didn't say, I quit. That's it. He said he's doing different work now.
On the other hand, see, the disadvantage is, me standing at the blue light suddenly went.
Yes, let's take
I'll
a
keep
call.
My joke for later.
Good morning, you're on the radio. Turn it down.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air. Turn down your radio.
Oh, sorry about that. Hi, Jim. This is Cesar. Cesar Bustamante. For Chris, I was wondering if you'd be willing to answer. If you were to actually pick a story arc that you've done in the past that you'd like to see in film, what would it be?
Well, we were just talking about it. The X-Men Asgardian Wars.
Oh, sorry, I missed that.
I mean, well, it was just something that we were talking about here in the studio. To me, that would be utterly cool. You know, get together all the X-Men, send them up against Loki, Storm turning into the Goddess of Thunder, Wolverine being stomped by goodness knows what, Kitty facing him down.
Anthony Hopkins.
Works for me. I mean, you know, we're just... That would be, for me as a writer, that would be a total giggle. But you'd have to get Disney and Fox to make nice with each other. And boy, you want to talk about to dream and impossible.
Right now.
That would be a challenge for any superhero. But, you know, Daredevil could pull it off, I bet you.
There you go. Ben Affleck again.
Just as a comic fan, I'd like to thank you for all the work you've done, and especially for Dark Phoenix Saga, which is one of my favorites. So thank you for answering my question, and I'm sorry I kind of repeated.
Oh, no, it's quite all right. And I have, you know, as I'm fond of saying, I'm not done yet. We're charging ahead on the first arc of Nightcrawler, and we have more than a few surprises in store as the elf gets... used to being alive again. Yes, to be a member of the classic X-Men, the classic Claremont X-Men team, you have to die and be resurrected.
Okay.
It happens all the time.
It does.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Okay. Now, at this point, I would have been signing off the show. I mean, we have, in theory, 30 seconds left before I would have to play something by Madeline Pryor who performs my outro.
Well, you can't have any of my discs.
I've got it all on MP3.
Oh, don't be a...
Or Wave, actually.
Don't.
I have unreleased DLI material.
Oh, God, that's not fair.
It's fair. I got it from Madeline Pryor.
Well, that's even more not fair.
And Peter Knight, who quit Steel Eye.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, about 7 months ago, I got his newsletter.
I should really pay more attention.
Yeah. Well, they haven't done an album since he left, and they haven't done an American tour. They do something every summer somewhere to Cropity, which is, a festival of that kind of Steel Eye Fairport Convention and all of those. And so let's take more calls until Lister gets here.
Sounds good.
Good morning. You are on the radio. Hi there.
WBI?
You're on the air.
Oh, okay, great. I just want to ask a question. Which is actually two questions. I'm going to make it real quick. One, how come they make so many Batman and Superman movies? And the second question, will there ever be another Predator and Alien? Since it seems like Predators and Aliens are constantly popping up periodically.
Well, these are things that Chris doesn't write, but what's your opinion, Chris?
I don't know. That's a Warner Brothers, the Warner Brothers side of the street. I guess they keep making them until they get them right, and then they try and make them again to make them better.
Chris is nowadays mostly on the Marvel side.
Well, and as far as Alien Predator goes, I certainly wouldn't object if they came back and said, "Let's make a film adaptation of Deadliest of the Species." I mean, to me, that's a cool story where you have a female alien, a female predator, and a female human, and they're the good guys.
Mm.
So imagine sitting there rooting for an alien, rooting for the predator. You know, that could be fun. Or at least I thought it could be fun.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows?
You maybe pitched that?
No, it was a comic.
It was one you wrote.
It was a graphic novel. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
If anybody,
have you pitched it?
No, but if anybody from LA is listening, I'll be more than happy to give it a shot.
I have a question. So, but my question is, and Predator was one time novels.
No,
or they became movies.
No, they were movies first, and then spawned novels like
novelizations.
And novels.
And then sequels to
and
the
comics, and yeah. I'm sure poems and Etch-a-Sketches, and everybody.
But they all started with Arnold.
Who I've seen a recent photograph of as King Conan.
Oh, God.
Hey, it looks pretty darn good, you know? It looks better, actually, than the scene at the end of Conan. So we'll be curious to see how that all pans out.
Yeah, no, King Conan is a good idea, but by that time we're at Sprague de Camp, aren't we? We're no longer Robert E. Howard. We're,
you know,
I hardly read those books, but I knew Sprague, who was, you know, the complete expert.
Not meaning to change. Mm-hmm. I would like to see them make a movie. I would like to see them make a movie where Batman meets Superman.
Well, that's the next one. They're filming it now.
They just started yesterday.
Wow.
So it'll be out in 2 years?
Yeah, it's, I think it's... I think it's a 2016 film, a May 2016 film.
Cool.
That's going to be a nice one.
Yeah, right? Well, all depends who's running for president.
Yep, there's truth to that. Okay,
like Spider-Man meeting somebody else, huh? Spider-Man meeting who would Spider-Man and another superhero?
Well, I always liked Spider-Man and the X-Men. That was fun.
Okay, so let's say Spider-Man and X-Men unite.
Been there, done that.
They have done that already.
They got the
Chris
living.
Did that.
They got the living daylight speed out of them.
The person you are talking to wrote that. Okay.
Uh huh.
Aha.
Uh-huh. And Spider-Man won the battle.
Trounced.
Yeah, I think...
That's a good verb.
I'm just trying to think of which... Yeah. Yep.
Spidey trounced.
Spidey always does. I mean, he's Spidey. That's the whole point.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Take care. And good morning. You are on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Chris Claremont, number one. Thanks for everything. And I got to ask you, what about Ilyana Rasputin? Would you ever want to do like a story arc going back to that stuff with Belasco and Sim? And I'm going to get off the air, but the other thing is Stiltman. What do you think about Stiltman? He's my favorite ridiculous Marvel character. Thank you very much.
I don't know. I haven't worked on Stiltman, I think, since the second or third script I ever wrote, which was back in the Ford administration. And as far as Ilyana and her backstory are going, I'm pretty sure that's a current arc or recently completed arc or recently projected arc in Marvel, current Marvel continuity. I can't say for sure because I'm not that familiar with it, but I would suggest check them out online and see what's happening. Or go down to your local comic book store and ask them.
Yeah.
I bet more than happy to to clue you in, and if they have any issues, sell you copies.
Come by coincidence, the next New York Review of Science Fiction reading will be held on East 32nd Street, down the block from Jim Henley's Universe. Go there. They can fill you in on the rest.
And
JHU, they don't call it Jim Henley's Universe anymore. It's just JHU.
Yeah, I can't follow that one.
It's a corporate
either.
Thing.
But, and also you have the June edition of the Reed Convention's New York Comic Con coming this June.
Ah, okay.
Which will hopefully provide the opportunity to get more of your questions answered. Assuming there's sufficient room to breathe in the Javits Center, much less move around, which was not the case at the New York Comic Con last fall. Woof! Talk about a vast quantity of people. It was worse than the F train at rush hour.
Oh, my God, yes.
He cackles.
They stopped inviting me at Comic Con. They invited me for 2 years to be a moderator on panels, and then I don't think it was that I was dropped. I think I was forgotten.
Well, remind them.
I don't even know who to remind. You'll give me a name later. Okay, fine.
The problem isn't being reminded. The problem is getting through the door and actually surviving the crush long enough to find a booth.
I usually find a booth to work at. It's a good way of doing it. I'm doing that at BEA.
I basically sit down in Artist Alley and don't move for 4 days.
Yeah.
Because it's just not worth the effort.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful convention.
Let the convention pass you instead of you move through it.
Well, suddenly one begins to appreciate the fact that there really are convention centers in California that are something like 600,000 to 700,000 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
San Diego is basically as long as the Trade Center is tall.
Yeah, but I mean, then there's Vegas. CES is a city.
Yeah, but the beauty of it is if you keep extending the San Diego Convention Center, sooner or later we're going to get to Tijuana.
There you go.
And imagine, no, Mom, I'm just going to the comic convention. And then you emerge in the United States.
The CES is so vast, I don't go anymore because I can't sell enough articles going to make
consumer electronics?
Yeah. It's larger than Comic-Con. It's larger than San Diego.
You mean there are more people who use computers than read comics? Zutalor.
And, well, they read their nowadays, many of them read their comics using their computers.
You need bigger screens.
You do for the most part.
And you also, unfortunately, you need screens that are side-angled, not, you know, that are tall, not vertical.
Well, you can do that. You can change them from portrait to landscape on a tablet. Very easy.
You need, on a desktop, you need like a 40-inch screen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be better. Otherwise, they make you see panel by panel, which means that the layout people can't really...
Because you lose the visual continuity.
You lose the ditko of it.
Yes. Well, it was...
using that word in a different way.
Well, the problem was when you look back at Ditko and you... as he babbles on. you look back at Ditko, you look back at Kirby, you look back at the classic storytellers of the 60s. You're talking a grid. It's... right, left, left, right, left, right, left, right. Nowadays, where you have a much more inventive graphic template, when you start dividing the page, you can sometimes lose key elements of the composite, and that's not good. And then, unfortunately, if you have a screen that's small enough to fit on your tablet, you can't read the damn dialogue.
No.
Of course, it would be easy then if you just had voiceover narrations and live actors.
Ah, well, there we go. The audiobooks. some of those, there are some weird things that have been done with that.
Aye, Chihuahua.
Not quite there yet. Good morning, you're on the radio.
Yeah, two things. You wrote a series of books, two or three, with George Lucas, the Shadow Store books.
Yep, three of them.
Yeah, three of them. I read the first one, excellent. If you just give any like vignettes or anything about working with Lucas, and that's it. That's all I got to say. Thank you very much, Ernie. Oh, you lived on a kibbutz too.
I worked on one when I was in college. Yes.
Oh, that must have been interesting too, man. But like, anyway, thank you very much for everything, man.
There's nothing like being woken up by the sound of jet fighters zooming overhead at 6 in the morning. There's nothing like having five members of the coup, actually, of driving down to a lot in the south of Israel we were going to go driving out into the Sinai, and we're going down the road, and suddenly we come to a roadblock, just like you'll find on the LIE at night, or the BQE. And they pull everybody over, and it turns out there's some activity along the border, and they want to get everybody together and form a convoy. And then when they get the convoy, they'll head south. And, well, the kibbutzniks in our two VW caravan weren't interested in waiting. So those of us who were not Israeli, we were the out-of-country volunteers. We were in the second VW. And the guy comes over to us and says, okay, we're driving. Do not stop. Whatever happens, do not stop. You understand me? You just go. Okay. Is there a problem? No. No problem. No problem. Everything's fine. Meanwhile, in the first truck, which is all the kibbutzniks, they pull a footlocker out from underneath the seats. They open the footlocker. They start distributing machine guns,
mm-hmm.
M16s, pistols. They start loading.
Oh, dear.
You know, I mean, suddenly, there are 10 people in this truck who are armed for bear. At which point, we broke all the speed limits going south and did a three-hour journey in about an hour and change. And Ray arrived safely. But it was what you call a different perspective on life.
Yes, I would imagine.
And the fact that, you know, every night, five guys went out on the kibbutz and walked the perimeter with loaded weapons, mm-hmm. with loaded Uzis and loaded assault rifles. You know, this is something you have to bear in mind.
Yeah.
On the other hand, walking through the old city was quite, quite extraordinary. God knows what it looks like now. After 40 years of high technology, but back mm-hmm. then it was just breathtaking.
Yeah.
What was his other question? Sorry, I forgot about that part.
I'm afraid so have I. But we actually have to start moving along, even though our replacement isn't here, because
Zitalor.
I need to, Lister, but among other things, I have to be awake driving back home.
Why? I haven't been awake driving for the last 3 days. It's very intriguing, I'll tell you.
Yes, exactly.
Whole new perception of reality.
So, yeah, as you were saying earlier. So, yeah, you don't want that danger point again. So we probably need to start signing off, and I am going to put on a recording almost at random to take us to 6 a.m. So,
well, it was good talking to all you people, and do keep following the adventures of Nightcrawler and the funny in the comics. I guarantee cool time.
Yeah, that was the next question is, are you working on anything else besides Nightcrawler at the moment?
Yes, I am.
But you can't say yet.
No, I can't.
Right. Okay. That is the nature of the industry.
But it's really cool beans.
Okay, Marvel? Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. Everybody, I hope you had your ear close to the radio for that one, so that you could get the telepathic answer. Yeah. you know.
That part of the brain hasn't worked for years.
The Xavier method of finding out the answer to that question.
No. Like Charlie, I take medication to blank down that aspect of my ability so I can walk.
So Nightcrawler is on your newsstands, just arriving?
No, it's not on the newsstands. It's in the comic book shops. The second issue just came out. Third issue will be out in hopefully 3.5 weeks, and the fourth issue a month after that. And we just got picked up, greenlit for a full year.
Oh, cool.
So
Very nice.
For all intents and purposes, we're treating it as an ongoing series, and where Nightcrawler's concerned,
he's a great character.
It's going to be fun. I mean, yeah. Actually, the one surprise I had